Thank you very much. Thanks to the award committee for awarding me this Xanthopoulos Prize. Thank you very much to the organizers for giving me the opportunity to talk at GR18. And finally, I want to apologize not to be able in Sydney in person. The talk title is The Quantum Einstein Equations, and I will basically cover how they are implemented in the field of loop quantum gravity. After some motivational remarks, I will talk about canonical quantization in general, then loop quantum gravity in particular. I will come to the quantum Einstein equations, which is the focus of this talk, and finally, I will give you some summary and open questions. For a long time already, physicists have been speculating whether a quantum gravity theory, a theory which combines the principles of quantum mechanics and general relativity, might be able to cure ultraviolet singularities of ordinary quantum field theory and or singularities of classical general relativity. And for almost 70 years or so, people have been trying to construct such a theory and without real success so far. And I want to explain a little bit why this is the case, why it's so difficult. So let us recall that gravity is geometry, and curvature is the same thing as matter energy density. And what this brings about is, what it says in terms of the Einstein equations, is that geometry is nothing which is prescribed, which is given to us once and for all, and matter propagates on it. But there's an interaction between geometry and matter. And this is described very well by the Einstein equations. How dynamic geometry can be, we know very much from binary star systems where we have actually gravitational waves. And this thing, this fact that geometry is not a static entity, but is a dynamical object, in other words, that there's no background geometry given to us once and for all, is very much in conflict with the principles of quantum field theory, which can be seen very clearly in various stages, for example, in terms of the causality axiom. So, for example, for a scalar quantum field theory, we can talk about smeared quantum field operators. So here's a test function, F, and those test functions can have various supports. And if the supports of those test functions are space-like separated, as indicated by this light cone structure here, then actually the field operators are supposed to commute with each other. So one sees from this the following thing, namely that we need, in order to formulate the algebra of field operators, we actually need a background geometry, because only then we know what the light cone structure, or in other words, the causality structure of the spacetime is that we are talking about. When we don't have this background geometry at our disposal, then we can't even talk about the algebra of field operators. So the whole framework somehow collapses. The framework also ignores gravitational back reaction. It's a poor approximation in extreme cosmological and astrophysical situations that we're interested in particular when we talk about the early universe or black holes. And of course, people have been trying to use the perturbative approach of quantum field theory, but this doesn't work because of non-renormalizability of the gravitational field. So what we need are the Einstein equations, the quantum Einstein equations, where these operator heads have to be given a rigorous mathematical meaning. And the theory that we try to construct here will be a background independent one, and that's a radical generalization of the principles of quantum field theory on curved spacetime, where we always have a background geometry at our disposal. So what we need is a quantum field theory on a differential manifold rather than a quantum field theory on a spacetime with a background metric. And this particular means that we can't have something like Fock space, Hilbert spaces, Fock representations, because Fock representations always make use very much of the background metric. So let me give you an intuitive picture of what we are trying to do is to go away from this picture, which is quantum field theory on curved spacetime. So we have here some matter propagating on a rigid lattice made from bars and clocks. What we are trying to do in contrast is to do something like this. Namely, we have to take into account that geometry and matter must talk to each other, and in particular, matter can only be where geometry is excited. So what the challenge is to construct a fundamental theory of quantum mechanics and general relativity, which is valid very much down until the Planck scale, where there's complete quantum chaos. And what we see here are 5 magnifying glasses with a magnifying factor of about 1,000,000 laid on top of each other. So what we are trying to do is to construct a theory up here and try to get back the smooth space-time structure that we know about in everyday life. So let me now come to the next topic of my talk, namely the classical formulation of, or the canonical formulation of general relativity. So canonical means that we are taking advantage of the fact that globally hyperbolic spacetimes can be always be foliated into space and time. And then we construct a phase space of fields with a Poisson bracket, and we construct constraints. And this is very much known from the in terms of the ADM formulation, but it turns out for quantization purposes that one should go away from this ADM formulation and go to a connection formulation. And this is what I'm going to describe on this transparency. So we are starting with the ADM variables Q and K, the intrinsic metric of the hypersurfaces and the extrinsic curvature. And then let little e be the triad, which is from which the three metric can be reconstructed. And let gamma be its spin connection. From those fields, we can now construct connection variables. This is an SU2 connection and a densitized triad, which enjoy canonical Poisson brackets, and G is the Newton constant. Notice that you might have heard about this Ashtika variables before. In the early time, they were complex valued. Nowadays, and we will see why in the later stages of the talk, these have to be real valued. So there's no factor of I here. So in particular, there are constraints and the additional constraints, which comes about because we're using a connection formulation rather than a metric formulation, is the so-called SU2 Gauss constraint, the spatial diffeomorphism constraint, where F is the curvature of A, and finally the Hamiltonian constraint, which can be also constructed from the curvature plus additional terms, which I will not display here for purposes of this talk. This classical theory now should be quantized. And the canonical quantization program has been laid out by Dirac already a long time ago in the 50s. What one does is to construct, first of all, a so-called kinematical Hilbert space, a Hilbert space which doesn't know anything about the constraints, which is just there in order to quantize the basic fields. In our case, these will be these triads, these densitized triads, and the connection fields. This representation should satisfy a couple of properties, one of them being that the constraints should be implementable as self-adjoint operators. And then we want to solve the constraints, namely the classical the fact that classically we are interested only in this part of the phase space where the constraints are vanishing is reflected in the quantum theory by asking that the physical Hilbert space are only those elements of the kinematical Hilbert space where the constraints operators are, on which the constraint operators are vanishing. So kinematical Hilbert space is the kernel of the constraints. There are several obstacles, as in particular when we come to the quantization of the gravitational field. As we saw from this non-polynomial structure of the constraints, there will be severe factor ordering problems when we come to quantization. And furthermore, since these fields that we were talking about will become operator value distributions, there will be presumably a severe ultraviolet divergences as in ordinary quantum field theory. And also there might be anomalies around, and this is particularly severe in the context of the Hamiltonian constraint, because the Hamiltonian constraint, while it classically closes upon, not upon itself, but it closes with respect to the spatial diffeomorphism constraint. So the algebra does close among itself because the Hamiltonian with the Hamiltonian becomes a spatial diffeomorphism constraint, where C of n is a smeared Hamiltonian constraint. This algebra is not a true Lie algebra because the structure constants are not constants. They are actually functions, non-trivial functions on the phase space. And this is displays this algebra as not being a Lie algebra. And this is very difficult to implement anomaly freely in the quantum theory. These kind of obstacles have prevented progress for a long time, in particular in the ADM formulation. Most notably, here's the famous Wheeler-DeWitt equation. This equation in the representation that was considered by Wheeler and DeWitt is way too singular. One could not make mathematical sense out of this equation. Just as a side remark, in the early days when one was talking about the connection variables, one was really considering complex variables because in terms of these, one could actually find a polynomial version of the Hamiltonian constraint. This, unfortunately, does also not work because so far one could not find a Hilbert space representation of these complex variables, and moreover, the constraint, the Hamiltonian constraint, turns out to be still too singular, even using the complex variables. So this is mainly the reason why nowadays only the real variables that I defined before are used. The progress in loop quantum gravity now rests on the following three facts. First of all, one can really give a rigorous definition of a kinematical Hilbert space. There's a novel technique to cure ultraviolet singularities like those that we encounter in this Wheeler-DeWitt equation. And there's now a new program or a new way to implement the constraints in terms of the so-called master constraint program, which avoids the anomaly issues that I was talking about before. So let me give you first a glimpse of the quantum kinematics. So instead of using the unsmeared fields, A and E, I will use smeared fields. I will smear them in the following way. Instead of talking about a connection, I will talk about its associated holonomy. Instead of the triad variables, I will talk about so-called electric flux variables, which are called this way because of analogy with Young-Mills theory. So the E's are smeared along two-dimensional surfaces, and the E's, the connections along one-dimensional paths. And these variables enjoy a nice Poisson structure and a nice star structure. So A of E is an SU2 valued element. This is reflected in this equation. And E of S is just a real number. So here's the basic idea. If you have a two-dimensional surface and a one-dimensional path which intersect each other, for example, in this intersection point here, then the Poisson structure, the Poisson bracket between a holonomy and the flux gives you again, two holonomies, namely those which are along the first piece of the path until the breaking point and then until the second part. And now we want to quantize this algebra, this star Poisson algebra. And the first remark here is that this is highly ambiguous because in quantum field theory, there's never a unique representation, which is in contrast to the so-called Stone von Neumann theorem that we know about from quantum mechanics with finitely for systems with finitely many degrees of freedom. But it turns out that in loop quantum gravity, there is a unique representation if you add additional physical input. Namely, in this case, we have, for example, the spatial diffeomorphism group at our disposal, which we want to be such that it's implemented unitarily on the Hilbert space. And if you ask that and certain other natural technical requirements that you usually ask, then you get this uniqueness result, that there's only one representation. And this representation I will describe now in brief terms. So the wave functions are basically complex valued functions of the connection of the following form. If you have a collection of edges, then this collection, the union of these edges form what we call a graph. So for each such graph, we have several functions from the number of copies of SU2 according to the number of edges in the graph into the complex numbers. and they are of this form. So for each entry here, you have a group element A of E1 until A of En. And this is a complex function, valued function of these n holonomies. These are the wave functions. The holonomy operators act by multiplication in this representation. The electric flux operator acts by derivation. So this is very much an analogy to the usual Schrödinger representation of quantum mechanics. And here for the experts, if you want to know, this is the scalar product between such wave functions, where we have here the Hahn measure on SU2 entering. So you see that a lot of structure of SU2 comes here into play, and this is why it's also not surprising that in order to write down a basis in this Hilbert space, one has to use the representation theory of SU2. So it turns out that an orthonormal basis in this Hilbert space are the so-called spin network functions, which you can think of as the analogs of the Hermite polynomials in ordinary quantum mechanics. And for the time being, it will be enough to say that these spin network functions are labeled by graphs, and each graph is charged with a spin quantum number. And the spin comes in because, of course, because we are talking about SU2 and irreducible representations of SU2, which turn out to be labeled by spin quantum numbers. I want to give you a physical interpretation of the spin quantum numbers, and this is why I use the so-called area operator. So this is the classical area functional for a surface, and this is the expression of this area function in terms of the basic variables, namely these triad variables. And so very surprisingly, this operator can be quantized on the Hilbert space of loop quantum gravity. This is a complete surprise because this is not possible on a Fock space. So that's very nice. The spectrum of this operator is explicitly known, and the eigenfunctions turn out to be just these spin network functions. And for example, now we can give a physical meaning to the spin quantum numbers. Namely, it turns out if an edge intersects the surface along which we take the area, then it contributes to the error, a quantum of error, which is given by LP squared times the square root of J times J plus 1, if J is the charge of the spin with which the edge is charged. So this seems to indicate that in loop quantum gravity, we have a discrete structure at Planck scale. And similar results hold for length and volume operators. So this is just to convince you that we have some kind of correspondence principle. So the eigenvalues crowd very much when you go to a large area, so that we get a quasi-continuum. And this shows that the number of eigenvalues grows exponentially as we go to higher and higher area. For what I have in mind later on in this talk is I want to give you an intuitive picture of the quantum geometry and also how it changes in time. And this can be done as follows. So this is a graph which is now colored, and the colors stand for the spins. Low spin corresponds to red colors, high spin to blue colors. And we can talk also about this in a dual picture, namely if you have a cell complex, for example, a triangulation, and you go to the dual graph, which is obtained by connecting interior points of neighboring tetrahedra by edges to the faces according to which along which they are glued, then you get the dual graph. So we get a dual cell complex, and this will be of some importance in what I'm going to talk about later. Also, what I need in order to tell you this is just to mention the fact that there is something like coherent states that we have now in loop quantum gravity. These are states which are minimal uncertainty states for these electric fluxes and holonomy operators. So this is just the fact that expectation values of holonomies and electric fluxes are reproduced with respect to those states. So these states are labeled by points in the classical phase space. And the minimal uncertainty relation is saturated. So this picture just shows that these states have some kind of Gaussian structure. Don't have time to go into details. And now we come to the quantum Einstein equations, which is the focus of this talk. It turns out, as I said before, that it's necessary in a sense to go to the master constraint problem. So the master constraint is essentially the squared sum of all the constraints. And the reason behind doing this is twofold. First of all, the condition that M should vanish is equivalent to the vanishing of the individual constraints. And furthermore, the requirement of being a gauge invariant variable, namely that the Poisson bracket between such an gauge invariant variable F and with all the constraints should vanish is equivalent to this equation. So this means that first of all, the master constraint captures the same information about the as the individual constraints. It avoids the complications with the non-Lie algebra structure of these constraints, because when you talk about only one constraint, there's a trivial algebra. And the master constraint program that I will be talking about in a second was also positively tested in several examples. The thing that makes this work now is in a certain sense given to us by background independence. So it turns out that ultraviolet singularities are automatically cancelled in background independent theories, and in loop quantum gravity one can explicitly see this as follows. So here we have the square root of the determinant of q at the point x, which turns out to be a operator value distribution, and if you integrate this you get the volume operator. The basic structure of the master constraint is a fraction where the numerator consists of n plus 1 operator value distributions multiplied at the same point divided by the nth power of this operator. And it turns out that when you use operator product expansion techniques, that the singularity structures of numerator and denominator are equal to each other, and so that the ultraviolet divergences actually cancel each other. So you end up with a nice operator value distribution, and when you integrate it, you get an operator. So as I said before, this is due to background independence. It works in more general context as well. And what one needs here when you think about this is 1 over the determinant of that q of x, as I said, is something like the inverse volume. The inverse volume operator does not exist in the theory because the volume operator has a huge kernel. But there's an additional technique that allows you to, which is a classical identity, which allows you to express the inverse volume as a well-defined operator in the quantum theory. And this is at the heart of the loop quantum cosmology, truncation of loop quantum gravity that Martin Boyevard will talk about after this talk. Just as a side remark, black hole and Big Bang singularities can also be resolved in loop quantum gravity, but the results here are significantly less than in loop quantum cosmology, where the model is simple enough in order to solve the theory more or less completely. Just in order to illustrate for example, how you can see this ultraviolet avoidance for the operators, then I will give you a simple situation. Namely, we'll talk about a cubic graph and a cubic cell complex dual to it. And then we can, for example, look at the Hamiltonian for SE2 Young-Mills theory. This has been done by Kogut and Susskind in the 70s. And what we have here, we have the electric field smeared along the dual surfaces of these complexes. And we have here the connection smeared along the loops in this lattice, the plaquettes. And the only interesting thing for us here is that there's a 1 over epsilon here, where epsilon is the lattice length with respect to the background metric of Young-Mills theory. When you do this for gravity, and we do this for the master constraint, then the structure is, of course, the algebraic structure of this constraint is, of course, different. In particular, there's this volume operator appearing here. But the most interesting thing for us is that instead of a 1 over epsilon, we have an h bar over L Planck to the fourth. And since B, the volume operator, scales as L Planck to the cube, we see that basically L epsilon got replaced by LP. So this is precisely the way in which loop quantum gravity serves as a regulator of these divergences. And there's also no continuum limit to be taken, because we don't even know what this lattice size is. So there's a precise sense in which loop quantum gravity is already a continuum theory. It turns out that one can also say something about the solution space to the constraint. So basically, this is Dirac's idea, that we want to have states which are in the kernel of the master constraint. And one can give a heuristic solution in this form, which, however, is not normalizable in the kinematic inner product. And there's a technique to go about this, which goes by the name of rigging maps. There's a rigorous formulation of this, because we can make use of the fact that the master constraint is a self-adjoint operator, and then use spectral techniques in order to solve the constraint. Finally, I want to say something about the semi-classical limit of the theory. This has been an open question for a long time, because the form of the constraint is actually very difficult. And in terms of the Hamiltonian constraint, there was little progress, but it turns out, in terms of the master constraint, you can do that. So there's a theorem which says that the expectation value of the master constraint in this kinematical equivalent states is reproduced. By the way, we have to use kinematical equivalent states rather than solutions of the constraint in order to test whether the constraint has been satisfactorily quantized. Otherwise, the question is meaningless, because physical equivalent states are in the kernel of the constraint by the definition. So this is the use of these kinematical equivalent states. And the fluctuations of the operator are small, of the order of h bar. So what this means is that the master constraint has been correctly implemented. And furthermore, that coherent states which are peaked on the constraint surface in the phase space can be used as approximately physical states. So let me close this with open questions. So first, one question is that the master constraint is, of course, still suffers from factor ordering ambiguities, and these are poorly understood physically. The physical Hilbert space is non-empty only, of course, if the master constraint has zero in its spectrum, and this might actually select the correct factor ordering for us, but also little known is about this. To do actual calculations, we need more about the explicit structure of the physical Hilbert space, and maybe approximation techniques, and this kinematic coherent states, which are approximately annihilated by the master constraints, might do this for us. I haven't been able to talk much about the classical problem of time here in this talk, but it can be actually solved at the classical level, as has been shown by the Rovellis and others. What has not been done is to quantize this framework, in particular to quantize observables, operators which act on the physical Hilbert space. One would like to make a connection with quantum field theory on curved space-time, and to make connection with renormalization and effective quantum field theory program. And of course, I have been very sloppy in this talk, and you can see the details in my forthcoming book. And before I close, I would like to show you a film which illustrates the central features of the Einstein equations. So what we are going to see now are the Einstein equations in action. So we are going to see this colored dual cell complex that I was talking about before. And what we will see is how the colors, that is the spin or the area of these triangles on these simplices, is going to change according to the quantum Einstein equations. What we're also going to see is how whole tetrahedra or triangles are going to disappear or are going to be created, also according to the quantum Einstein equations. And well, this is what we are flying now through a dynamical quantum universe, so to say. One should be stressing that these void areas between these crystal regions are not vacuum space, but there are actually no space at all. This is where geometry is not excited, and these are so more or less holes in the space-time, and what this means is that in loop quantum gravity, there's topology change all over the place, at least at short distances, i.e. at the Planck scale. By the way, this is an animation and not a simulation, so to solve the quantum Einstein equations numerically, this is a project for the future. This is just to illustrate the basic idea, namely how the colors, that is the spins or the areas on the triangles, are changing in time. Thank you very much for your attention.